Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On February 22nd, NASA announced a landmark discovery in the search for life on other planets. The agency's Spitzer Space Telescope has revealed the first known star system with seven Earth-sized planets, three of which are potentially habitable. Joining us now by phone is project scientist for NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope, Michael Werner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
The name of this star system is TRAPPIST-1. Can you tell us about the star and how the planets were first detected?
Right. Well, the TRAPPIST project is a project organized by some Belgian astronomers. They cooked up an acronym because TRAPPIST is a form of Belgian beer. The way these planets were found is by what's called the transit technique, where you have a telescope, you point it at a star, and monitor it for days on end in the hope that if there's a planet orbiting that star, it will be aligned so that it passes along your line of sight so that it blocks a bit of the light from the star and you see the star dim. And if that occurs on a periodic basis, it's attributable to a planet orbiting the star.
Give me a sense about how many stars have been observed in this way.
In this way, the main telescope that's done this type of observation is called the Kepler telescope. It's another NASA project. Mm-hmm. It actually observed several hundred thousand stars simultaneously looking for transits. But because of the fact that you only see them when the alignment is just right, it found thousands of planets. The TRAPPIST project has looked at about 50 of these stars, and they found this one really exciting system.
How do they pick which stars they're going to look at in the first place?
That's a good question. And this group has chosen to look at a particular type of stars. They're very faint, small red stars, intrinsically faint. They're quite common. And the reason they made that choice is that the planet is bigger compared to the star if the star is small. And that makes this so-called transit a bigger signal, more of the light from the star is blocked when the planet passes in front of it.
The three planets I mentioned at the introduction that are categorized as being in the so-called Goldilocks zone. What does that mean?
Right. That's another good question. If you remember Goldilocks and the Three Bears, if the planet is too close to the star, it's too hot, which means that water couldn't be liquid on the surface. If it's too far from the star, it's too cold, and instead you get ice. So if it's in the so-called Goldilocks zone, has a temperature about the temperature of the Earth, then water could be liquid on the surface of the Earth, or that planet, rather, and that makes it a promising site for life, the development of life as we know it. So it's sometimes called the habitable zone.
You've already described the idea of the transit and how that helps you view that there's an object orbiting the star, and in this case, seven. How can you learn much more than that from so far away?
Another good question. Well, you have to remember that these seven planets are all packed into a region which is very much smaller than the orbit of Mercury. So they're really closely packed against the star. They're so close together that they interact with each other gravitationally. The planets themselves affect the orbits of their fellow planets. And that means that there are variations in the times that these transits occur, and those can be modeled out and used to estimate the masses of the planets. So from the transit measurement, you get the size from the fraction of the starlight that's blocked. From this timing variation, you get the mass. And together, the mass plus the size gives you the density. So you already know interesting things. And in fact, these planets have densities comparable to the density of the Earth. At that point, things get a lot harder. But if you look at enough of the transits, you might be able to infer something about the composition of the planet's atmosphere. And that's the next step in this process. It's being carried out now by the Hubble Space Telescope, not so much by Spitzer, and it will be done in the future from the James Webb Space Telescope, which is NASA's next big space telescope. And I'm sure people are using large telescopes on the ground in the same way.
When I was reading about this, the description of the planets and how close they are to each other said that it's possible that you could actually observe geographic features of nearby planets.
I think that's probably poetic license.
Okay.
But on the other hand, people are really, really clever, so I wouldn't put it past them. In other words, if you can, but I think that might be difficult.
Yeah, it sounded kind of weird where they said you could see cloud systems and that sort of thing. But the illustrations of the planets released by NASA they're very cool looking, but mostly come from an artist's imagination too, right?
I think that's basically right. Maybe with a little bit of science tossed in, but we know what Mars looks like, we know what the Earth looks like, we know what Venus looks like. These planets are in the same relative position to their star as our terrestrial planets that I just named, Mercury, are to the Sun. That gives you a bit of an idea, perhaps, but it's pretty much of an artist's conception. It's fanciful, but interesting and certainly possible.
Does the type of star that it is tell us anything about how old this system might be?
Another good question. This star is thought to be several billion years old. The Sun is about 4.5 billion years old, and from indirect methods based on the motion of the star, it's estimated that this star is even older than that. And that's interesting for two reasons, of course. One is it means that if life has formed on these planets, which is pure speculation, I should say, there's been plenty of time for that to happen. And the other thing, of course, is that this system is what's called dynamically stable. In other words, even though there are all those planets in there, they're coexisting and not throwing each other out of the off the island, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's thought to be an old, mature star.
When we talk about habitable and other life on other planets, there's kind of two different things, right? There may be not necessarily life per se, but we may be. But that other question is, can we live there?
In terms of, well, let's see, it's a little different. It depends a lot on what's in the atmosphere and so forth. And then there's one other aspect of the system, which is a little unusual, which is it's thought that the planets are what's called tidally locked, which means that they have one side continually pointing at the star. And that's the case, people will know, in our solar system. And we only ever see one side of the moon because it's tidally locked to the Earth. So if we were there on one of these planets, we'd either be on the day side or on the night side. Maybe if we were sort of at the edge between the two, we could be quite comfortable.
Okay. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that Spitzer Space Telescope. If you could tell us a little bit more about where it came from and its history.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. It's the Spitzer Space Telescope is a telescope that operates at infrared wavelengths. And think of that as heat radiation. The star that I told you about, in addition to being small and faint, is cool. And so it radiates a lot of infrared radiation, which is why we were able to do this observation so effectively. Spitzer is one of NASA's so-called great observatories. It's a cousin of the Hubble Space Telescope, which works in optical and ultraviolet light. We do similar things in the infrared. We're located not orbiting the Earth. It was launched in 2003. We're orbit not the Earth, but the Sun. So we're far away from the Earth. And because of that, we were able to observe the TRAPPIST-1 system consecutively for 20 days. And that was the whole key to unlocking the structure of the solar system. Because there are so many of these planets that they're transiting one right after the other, often two or three at the same time. And it wasn't possible to untangle that without this very long data set, which extended for many days and saw many transits of each of the stars and could sort of put the puzzle together. We're now in our 14th year of observation with Spitzer, and it's been a great success. I appreciate the support of the public for such a project.
Does attention now turn from looking for other solar systems like this to focus on this one, on TRAPPIST-1, or do you just broaden, do you look for more of them?
Well, obviously, the group that discovered it, the Belgian group, is going to try to find more candidates of the same type. They have an expanded project with a bigger telescope than the one they have been using. And there are other groups carrying out transit explorations of other stars looking for other candidate planets. Other groups are trying to characterize or understand those planets. I'm sure there will be a temporary upsurge of interest in the TRAPPIST-1 system, but there are literally thousands of exoplanets known at this point, many of which are crying out to be studied and characterized. So that work will go on in parallel with a lot of energy and excitement.
And you said you thank the public for the support of this research, for the support of this search. Who does pay for it?
Well, the Spitzer Space, the TRAPPIST project is a Belgian project paid mm-hmm. for by Belgium and Switzerland, maybe. But the Spitzer project is a NASA project, and we're supported by the federal government, which is supported by the taxpayers, and we hope we're delivering good value for money.
Well, I thank you so much for your time today, Michael Werner. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ann, and best of luck to you and your listeners. I should say that there are scientists at Ohio State University who are effective and frequent users of our Spitzer telescope. So we have neighbors.
Okay. Michael Werner, project scientist for NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope. We're going to talk more about this exoplanet system, planetary system, when we return. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the recent NASA discovery of seven Earth-like planets orbiting a nearby star this hour. The star system is just 40 light years away.
Just 40 light years away.
And scientists believe the environments on three of those planets might be able to support life. Joining us now is astrophysicist at Ohio State University and the chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
I have to crack up. What is 40 light years?
Galactic terms, that is down the block. That's practically our next door neighbor. In human terms, the fastest space probe ever launched was NASA's New Horizons, which went along at 36,000 miles per hour, which is super fast. If it was headed in the direction of TRAPPIST-1, it would take it 600,000 years to get there. So only 40 light years.
So all of this study and searching is assuming that someday we'll figure out a way to travel through space faster.
Actually, I think the big motivational question that we're trying to answer is much more fundamental, is are we alone?
Okay.
We look at these billions, hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, trillions of galaxies in the universe. Are we it or not? So we're trying to answer that question first. Is there any life at all? Leave alone intelligent life. Just are there any microbes on another planet? How common is life in our universe?
And life in its very most fundamental forms.
Life in its fundamental forms and life as we would recognize it. That's why we're so focused on planets in their habitable zones where there can be liquid water, because life as we know it requires liquid water. Of course, maybe fancifully there can be other forms of life, but we wouldn't necessarily know how to recognize those, of what it would look like. So we're focusing on life as we know it and just hunting down, spending years and years studying these systems in detail, trying to answer that very philosophical, very motivational question.
What was your reaction to the news of the exoplanet discoveries?
Yay. Well, getting into this question of, are we alone? First step is how common are Earth-like planets with liquid water on their surfaces? That is an open question. That's a research question. And it's just so exciting to see this system that's just down the block in terms of the galaxy that doesn't have one planet with potentially liquid water, but three of them all in one system. And it's practically our next door neighbor. And then the news from last summer where our very nearest neighbor, Proxima Centauri, only 4 light years away, has an Earth-sized planet in the potentially habitable zone around it. It looks like it's beginning to look like Earth-sized planets with potentially liquid water are, you know, infesting the galaxy. They're everywhere.
Well, it looks like it because we now have a way to see them.
Yeah, now that we're looking for them, we
they've
can actually
around,
see them.
They've been around.
They've always been there, but now we can actually detect them.
And that one that's about 4 light years away, have we learned much more about that since it was discovered?
No, but there are more campaigns with longer observing times, bigger telescopes to try to get some more information on that planetary system.
All 7 of the TRAPPIST-1 planetary orbits are closer to their host star than Mercury is to our sun.
That's correct.
And, you know, that's kind of hard to imagine. Mercury being named very hot, very close
right.
to the sun.
Yeah.
Not habitable.
Not habitable at all.
This is a very different kind of star, however. It just, the whole visualization of this is kind of phenomenal.
Yeah. This TRAPPIST-1 star, like Michael Verner said, it's smaller than the sun. It's like only 9% the mass of the sun, which these small, cool, what we call dwarf stars are actually the most common kind of star in the universe. We just don't see them because they're small and dim, but they fill up the universe. We see them in every galaxy. And so most planets will orbit these kinds of stars because they're the most common kind of star out there. And yes, they can be close, packed into that star because it's just not very bright.
And they can be very close, so they're going to see more of the actual celestial body of it.
Well, the disk of their star will be smaller in their sky.
Okay.
So it's actually, that's why we use definitions like the habitable zone. It's not a fixed distance. It's not 93 million miles. It depends where the amount of sunlight reaching those planets is about the same amount of sunlight that we receive here on Earth. So it's a smaller star, but they're closer in, so it balances out.
My guest is Paul Sutter, an astrophysicist at Ohio State University and chief scientist at COSI. We're talking about that new discovery of TRAPPIST-1. It's a solar system about 40 light years away, give or take. And they've discovered 7 planets there, 3 of which are considered in the quote-unquote habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone, it's sometimes called. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, another aspect of this, Paul Sutter, is that the planets are all very close together, and they don't spin.
Right.
Which is weird to think about.
It'd be weird to think about actually being on the surface of one of these planets where you can be on one side of the planet and the sun never sets ever, or you can be on the opposite side of the planet and the sun never rises. So this opens up questions about like true habitability. Yes, they're in the technically in the habitable zone, but could life actually arise where there's no day-night cycles, where there's no seasons like that? Where one side would be baking hot because it's in sunshine all the time, and the other side is in permanent shadow. If these planets actually do have atmospheres, thick atmospheres, if they have liquid water oceans, then the atmosphere and the oceans can transport heat back and forth. There'd be very strong winds or very strong ocean currents to kind of balance it out the same way when we're on the night side of the Earth, we don't go down to 3 degrees above absolute zero because our atmosphere keeps us nice and warm like a blanket. So that kind of situation could be the case on these planets. We just need to dig in. We need to find out more. We need to figure out their atmospheres.
What makes the Earth spin? I know I'd learned this somewhere. But what makes the Earth spin, and why wouldn't these planets spin.
Right. So the natural state is for things in our universe to spin. If we look at how the solar system formed, there is a cloud of gas and dust. And if it just had a slight rotation, just a little bit, just a random rotation, then as it collapses, as it gets smaller and smaller, it's like a figure skater pulling their arms in, they start to spin faster and faster. And so as the planets coalesce, as the sun forms, all that momentum, all that spinning motion naturally gets translated into the motions of the orbits of the planets and then the spin of the planets themselves.
Are they all the planets in our solar system spinning?
Yes, but Mercury is very close to being tidally locked like these. It's slower, right. So the moon, as it orbits around the Earth, it does spin, but it spins at exactly the same rate that it orbits the Earth. So it's always turning to keep its face pointed towards, or one face pointed towards the Earth. And that's a consequence of the interaction of the tides of the Earth itself with the moon. It's a complex gravitational interaction that over the course of millions of years, if our moon used to spin, but it doesn't spin anymore. And so when you have close systems like this, closely packed systems, big mass differences, you get these kinds of tidally locked interactions.
Does the fact that all of these planets in TRAPPIST-1, that they're so close together, tell us anything about what's inside of them?
Yes. Like Michael was saying,
they are so close together and don't crash into each other.
Right. The system is stable. They don't crash. But we can look at the interactions between the planets. So this method of using the transit where we're just looking at the block of starlight as the planet passes in front of the star, that tells us some things. But it doesn't tell us a lot about the nature of the planet itself. But by looking at the interactions between the planets, we can get estimates of their density and their size and their mass. And so we can start to work back. Well, if you have an object yay big and its density is so-and-so, there's only so many materials that you can use to build planets. So we can ask, is it made of rock? Is it made of water? Is it all frozen, et cetera, et cetera? So we can learn about these planets just by looking at their interactions.
How do you determine the chemical makeup of a planet's atmosphere from so far away?
Yeah, so this is really cool, and we've actually done this before. So we'll repeat this exercise on the TRAPPIST system. When this transit occurs, when the planet starts to cross the face of its star from our point of view, that starlight passes through that atmosphere on its way to Earth. And so we can actually, by looking at the change in the starlight, so we can look at the starlight with no planets in front of it, kind of get a baseline. And then we can look at the starlight as it passes through that atmosphere. And that difference tells us what the atmosphere is made of. And we can figure out the chemical composition of those atmospheres.
Like, what would be aspect of the starlight that would change?
So depending, it all depends on the actual
elements.
Right,
but just an example of what
like
we already know.
An example, let's say you were looking at the Sun-Earth system and the sunlight passed through the Earth's atmosphere. Well, our own atmosphere, because of all the nitrogen and oxygen in our atmosphere, scatters blue light. And so you end up with a very reddish color when you look at sunlight that's passed through a lot of our atmosphere. And so if you were looking at that, you would see the signature of nitrogen and oxygen in our atmosphere based on how it scattered and based on how it interacted with that starlight.
Is that why sunsets are red?
That's exactly why sunsets are red.
We learned something new today. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. That's Paul Sutter, an astrophysicist at OSU and chief scientist at COSI. Give us a call if you have a question. You know I'll have lots of questions, but I'm always interested in listeners' questions, too. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook and post a question or a comment there. Now, I can't remember if it was Michael Warner from NASA earlier or you that said that cool red dwarfs are the most common.
Mm-hmm. We both said it.
Yeah, okay, you both said it.
Because
I probably, yeah. And that because they're so common, it's also likely that many of them also have planets. Mm-hmm. And that's why we focus on them.
Or we're starting to focus on them.
But are cool red dwarfs older?
Yes.
Does that tell us something about what expectations we could have for this long-term viability of these solar systems?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Smaller stars live a lot longer. The mass of a star determines its lifespan.
Oh.
A big, giant, massive star has an incredibly huge gravitational crushing pressure at its center. So its fusion reactions are all ramped up and accelerated, so it runs out of fuel really fast.
It's like little dogs and big dogs.
Exactly. Yes.
Sorry.
I'll use that analogy from now on.
Okay.
It works. So the big dog stars, they run through all their available fuel really fast. Really fast in astronomical terms, like 10 million years. Medium stars like our sun can slowly churn through their fuel, and our sun will last 9 billion years, and we're about halfway through that. Small stars just kind of – they're like the economy cars. They just sip on their gas, their available fuel, a little bit at a time. So they can persist for trillions of years. So when we see a star like this, a small cool red dwarf with a stable solar system – that star's not going anywhere for tens or even hundreds of billions of years.
It's expected to live a lot longer than the sun.
It's expected to live a lot longer. It probably formed a long time ago because it's still around. It didn't die a long time ago. And so there's many, many chances for life to get started on one of these potentially habitable worlds. You don't get just one 10-million-year shot. And if you mess that up, then too bad, the star is going to blow up. Or like in our own system, that the sun will only last for 10 billion years. If you have hundreds of billions of years to get life started, that's great if you have all the right conditions.
You said that you worked on the Spitzer Space Telescope. You've used it?
Yeah, way back in the day.
Well, what exactly are you doing when you use a telescope like this? Where are you? Are you just on a computer somewhere?
Yes, exactly. So when I worked on with the Spitzer Space Telescope, this was back in 2004, shortly after it launched, and I was doing an undergraduate research project at the University of Rochester, and we were using the Spitzer Space Telescope to actually look at planets being born in these very young systems, stars just getting started. We are looking for planets just beginning to coalesce. And when you operate an instrument like this, you're typing stuff into a computer. You're essentially, you get awarded a certain block of time. Say, okay, for the next 2 hours on this upcoming Wednesday, the telescope is yours. Point it wherever you want, do whatever you want with it. And so you program it. So, okay, I want to point at this coordinate on the sky for X amount of minutes. Then I need it to move over here.
And what do you see?
So it's collecting data. Excuse me. So even with something like a Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope, it's not like the raw images from the Hubble are piped in onto our computer monitors. And it's collecting data. Collecting that light onto photoreceptors and then recording the data like a digital camera.
Okay.
And then that digital data is sent back for further processing. And we're looking at images, and we're also doing something called spectroscopy, where we're looking at the elemental composition by looking at features in the light that's emitted by these objects. So we're looking at images, and we're trying to figure out the elemental composition of what we're looking at.
And then just to remind ourselves, as far as the light years thing goes,
mm-hmm.
When we see something that's 40 light years away, or we could even say 4 light years away, whatever
yep.
works for you, what point in time is that happening of what we're seeing? Is how many years ago?
Right. Yeah. So something that's 4 light years away.
Yeah.
It takes 4 years for the light or we'll stick to the TRAPPIST system. That's 40 light years away. That means 40 years ago, the light left that star crossed interstellar space and is now hitting our telescopes and instruments. So the image we have now is really an image of the nature of the system as it was 40 years ago. It's the exact same thing with the sun. The sun is 8 light minutes away. So the light that's coming into your window right now was released from the surface of the sun 8 minutes ago. That means if the sun were to like blink out of existence, it would take us 8 minutes to find out.
That's an interesting thing to think about.
Do you like thinking about the sun winking out of existence?
Well, you know, I'm a sci-fi fan. You know, it's been an issue. Science fiction before. What does all of this tell us about how unique the Earth is at this point, or do we still not know, and that's the ultimate question?
I mean, honestly, we don't know.
Yeah.
But it's pointing in the direction that the Earth or Earth-like planets, potentially habitable with water, with maybe thick atmospheres, maybe are pretty common. You know, there's some rough, very rough estimates based on the thousands of exoplanets we've discovered. Very rough estimates that in the Milky Way galaxy alone, just our own galaxy, there's maybe in the ballpark of, say, 5 million Earth-like planets around sun-like stars.
And learning about finding another planet, if nothing else, that where there's life as we know it on it, we could compare and contrast then and learn more about how life developed on Earth.
Absolutely. We're answering all these or we're starting to answer these broad range of questions. How common is life? What are the different circumstances where life can get started and start evolving and survive? It's just a big giant question mark that we want to chip away to get some answers.
We're going to continue our conversation. My guest is Paul Sutter. He's an astrophysicist at Ohio State and also chief scientist at COSI. We've been talking about the TRAPPIST-1, that's that new solar system. Well, it's not new. It's been around for a really long time. It's just been discovered about 40 light years away from the Earth. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, and we'll continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about the recent NASA discovery of 7 Earth-like planets orbiting a nearby star just 40 light years away. It is the first time so many planets of this kind have been found around the same star. Still with us is astrophysicist at OSU and chief scientist at COSI, Paul Sutter. If you have a question or comment, you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Paul Sutter, what are we surmising? Are we the big...
No, it's you and me.
Yeah. What are we surmising that gravity would be like on these planets?
Since these are Earth-sized planets and they're also roughly the same mass as the Earth and therefore the same density, it would feel about like home. Except for, you know, if there's no air or anything. But gravitational-wise, it'd feel about the same.
So assuming that it has the same kind of mass is real.
We know it has the same mass. Yeah,
okay.
That's one of our measurements.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. James in Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi. Hey, I just wondered, is the light spectrum for a dwarf star the same as our sun, or is it different? I wondered what kind of sunblock to pack.
Good optimism, James. Thanks.
You're thinking ahead. Yeah. You're already packing your bags for the 500,000-year-long voyage. So our sun emits mostly invisible light, which is not a coincidence because our eyes evolved to see the primary light emitted by the sun. But it also emits a little bit bluer than blue. So our sun emits in the ultraviolet, and then a little bit redder than red. It also emits a little bit in the infrared. And it's that ultraviolet radiation, the bluer than blue stuff, that causes skin cancer and makes you get a tan and all that. These ultra cool dwarfs, they don't peak. Their peak emission isn't in the visible. It's actually down there in the infrared with a little bit in the visible. So these actually look visibly red to us and emit very little ultraviolet radiation. So you probably wouldn't need sunblock on these planets.
Interesting. Even if you were on the sunny side?
Even if you were on the sunny side, it's going to look redder. It's going to look shifted down. It's emitting light still, so it'd keep you warm, but it's light that you can't necessarily see with your eyes.
Thank you, James, for that question. Any other questions out there? Please join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. NASA is set to launch a new space telescope next year, the James Webb Space Telescope. I think Michael Werner mentioned that earlier. Can you talk a bit about that project and what it's going to bring to the study of the universe?
Right. So the James Webb Space Telescope is considered the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. But the James Webb isn't going to be looking in visible light for the most part, like the Hubble is. It's actually going to be more focused in the infrared because the mission that we want this telescope to serve is best served by looking at infrared light. So James Webb is going to study planets around these kinds of stars. It's going to look at their atmospheres, look for the presence of oxygen. It's going to look for planets and stars being born. And it's also going to look for the very first generation of stars and galaxies to appear in our universe 13.5 billion years ago. It'll be hunting for those. And so all these science questions that we want to answer are answered in the infrared part of the spectrum. And so the James Webb will be an infrared, primarily an infrared telescope.
So in other cosmic news, there is a new data that raised questions about the speed of the expansion of the universe. Can you first of all talk about how we know the universe is expanding, and then how does it would affect projects like James Webb, or not at all?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So about 100 years ago, Edwin Hubble discovered that our universe is expanding. And he discovered this by looking at the motions of distant galaxies. And he found that on average, every galaxy is getting further away from every other galaxy. And so the natural conclusion is that our universe is expanding, which means in the distant past, it was much smaller. So we know the universe is expanding. And 20 years ago, we discovered that not only is the universe expanding, but the expansion is accelerating. So the universe is getting bigger and bigger, faster and faster every day. We actually don't totally understand that. We give this a name, this phenomenon. We call it dark energy. We don't fully understand why the expansion is accelerating. That's a current research topic. But what we're trying to do now is get a better handle on the history of expansion of the universe. So how has the expansion rate changed over time? Was it decelerating in the past and it's accelerating now? Is the acceleration getting faster and faster, et cetera, et cetera? Trying to get that detailed map. And this is, as you can imagine, a somewhat challenging problem that requires a lot of work and a lot of very careful statistical analyses and follow-up surveys. And we have a few main ways of probing the expansion rate of the universe. One is by looking at distant supernova, and another is looking at light emitted when the universe was very, very young. We call this the cosmic microwave background. And by studying the properties of that light, we can figure out the expansion rate.
Where do you find that light?
It's all around us. Yeah. if you were to put on microwave goggles, you'd actually be able to see this. It is light emitted when the universe was about 300,000 years old, and it permeates the universe today. And it's all around us. We can detect it and map it out and essentially get a baby picture of the universe.
If the universe is expanding at what and faster than we thought before, or it's speeding up, does that mean that the TRAPPIST-1 is getting farther away from us?
I should say when we're talking about the expansion of the universe, this is the subject of cosmology, the study of the whole entire universe.
Yeah.
Stuff like individual galaxies are smaller than the cells of your own body.
Yeah.
So on these kinds of scales. So it just doesn't matter. All our little local interactions don't affect the expansion of the universe, and the expansion of the universe doesn't affect our little local interactions. So our galaxy will stay held together, but neighboring galaxies, galaxies that are pretty far away, those are going to be pulled away from us.
Is TRAPPIST-1 in our galaxy?
It is. So our whole Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light year across. And TRAPPIST is only 40, with, you know, only 40
right around
down
the corner,
block.
Down the yep. block, right. Let's see. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. I have kind of two questions here. First of all, how would you know that the planets around TRAPPIST-1 would be tidally locked? And the second thing is, I always thought that atmosphere was actually held in by gravity. So I know you may have just made the quip earlier about you go out and you find you have no atmosphere. But shouldn't there be an atmosphere, or is there any reason it would be substantial, other than the fact that there may not be any life to, make, say, make free oxygen to make it different?
Those are both great questions. The first question, how do we know they're tidally locked? We don't know for sure, I should say that. We suspect strongly that they're tidally locked because when you have objects orbiting another larger body that close in, they almost always end up being tidally locked.
Why?
Physics.
Okay.
We see it in our own solar system, like the moon to the Earth, okay. like Mercury to the sun, which is very close to being tidally locked. Like the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, we see those getting tidally locked. And it's just it's an interaction. When the moon orbits the Earth, it raises tides. We get tides on the Earth. And those tides actually go back and exert a gravitational influence on the moon and end up twisting around the moon. So over the course of millions of years, they affect each other. So we strongly suspect these planets are tidally locked. They may not be. There may be some extra gravitational resonances that break them out of being tidally locked. We also see these kinds of situations play out in the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So if they're not tidally locked, they're close to being tidally locked.
If the moon was tidally locked, would it change how our tides?
So our moon is tidally locked.
It is. That's right.
So we always see the same
right.
face.
Okay.
And that's a consequence of the fact that it raised tides on the Earth. And
okay.
the Earth raised small tides on the moon, too.
OK.
And the second question, what was the second question? I got so excited about tidally
and I cut
locked.
Him. Oh, wait. David, don't go away.
Atmosphere. How do we know about atmosphere? So that is also an excellent question. Shouldn't we just assume there is an atmosphere? Well, if you look at the three planets in the habitable zone of our own sun, Earth, Venus, and Mars, they're all roughly the same size. Venus and Earth are very close to being the same size, and then Mars is a little bit smaller. Only one of them is truly habitable. Venus is certainly not habitable, and Mars is not habitable. Venus has a thick, super crushing atmosphere. Earth has a nice, friendly atmosphere. And then Mars essentially has no atmosphere at all. So just based on the size of a planet, you can't tell if there's going to be an atmosphere. And we have examples of that in our very own solar system, where three planets of about the same size have three very different kinds of atmospheres. There's other physics that come into play about whether you get to have an atmosphere and keep an atmosphere.
David, thanks for that question. And Fred in Grove City, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. So we were always talking about the probability that life exists on another place, but I want to look at it from the opposite angle. So given that there are Earth-like planets and sun-like suns, what might be, let's say, the top three things that would prevent life from evolving?
Okay.
Yeah. So only three things.
The top three.
The top three. And actually, that's a good question when it comes to this TRAPPIST system. These small red dwarf stars that are super common, and there's probably lots of planets that orbit these stars. These stars are also sometimes called flare stars. They are much more unstable than stars like our sun. So even though they'll be around for tens or hundreds of billions of years, they can all of a sudden increase in brightness by 40%. And then back down and then send out a huge flare. They'll have huge star spots instead of sunspots. They're star spots on other stars that can cover like half the face of the star. And so if your life trying to get started on this TRAPPIST system. Maybe you got a foothold. Maybe you're starting to evolve in. You're starting to have a good time. And then it flares up and blasts you with a huge dose of UV radiation that you're not used to. And you're kaput. So it's things like that. There's stability of the star is a big, perhaps a big deal in the letting life evolve. Things like being able to sustain a magnetic field might be important because a magnetic field lets you sustain an atmosphere, protects atmospheres from being stripped away by solar winds. We think this is what happened to Mars. 3 billion years ago, Mars had liquid water on its surface. It had an atmosphere, but it lost its magnetic field and its atmosphere was stripped away and its oceans evaporated.
Do we know why it lost its magnetic field?
We think it lost its magnetic field because Mars is smaller than the Earth. And so its molten core, which is what generates the magnetic field of the Earth, cooled off and solidified. And so once that cooled off, the magnetic field shut off and the solar wind from our sun just stripped away its atmosphere. We think that's what happened about 3 billion years ago. So stability of the star, strong magnetic field, maybe a large moon might be helpful to prevent comets and asteroids. Instead of slamming into the planet, they just slam into the moon instead. There's all sorts of things. Those are just the three first things off the top of my head.
As far as the stability issue goes of the star, can we figure out a history of stability of the star? Can we learn anything about what its history is?
And when it comes to one particular system, we can't go back in time and say, oh, yeah, you know, 200 million years ago, there was a huge flare. And so it probably cooked any life. But it's more of a statistical answer. We look at many, many different kinds of these or many different stars of this kind. And so we can figure out the general rate. OK, on average, every, say, 100 million years, there's a large flare just based on the number that we see today flaring up. And so you can make statistical guesses about one particular system.
Okay. Fred, thanks a lot for that call. We have a message from Kathy on Facebook who says, in regards to wormholes, is that a real non-hypothetical thing? And if so, how could that play a role eventually in reaching these new planets?
Okay. Yeah. Wormholes, not a thing.
Not a thing.
Boom.
Catherine in Columbus asks, how will scientists test the air of these new planets?
Yeah, and that's by looking at the light
sun
as it passes through the atmosphere.
Star sun. Yep. Yeah, okay. And Rod from Columbus asks, how fast is the speed of eyesight in space?
The speed of light is the speed of light
that
in
is
vacuum.
Eyesight.
Yep.
Okay. So we got all those. And the recent news that SpaceX, the company headed by Elon Musk, announced a plan to send a couple of tourists around the moon and back to Earth in 2018. I guess they're probably having to pay
a little bit
of money. So can you afford it?
I certainly can't afford it. Okay. By the way, if any of my bosses are listening, you know, you can give me a raise or send me along. And, you know, 2018 for SpaceX to send a tourist around the moon. At this rate, Elon Musk, he's probably going to say, you know, in 2024, I'm going to send a tourist to the TRAPPIST-1 system. Like, it's just seeing, like, it's a little bit, that seems a little bit rushed. I definitely, even if they are able to get it off the ground in 2018, I don't think I want to be the first person.
Okay. Well, Paul Sutter, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me. Fun topics.
Paul Sutter, he's astrophysicist at OSU. He's also chief scientist at COSI. Want to thank the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, the AllSides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides, and you can follow me too at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.